Now, from the left coast to the D.C. Beltway, covering the topics you love to hate and hate to miss, it's the Silk or Joe Show.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Silk or Joe Show. Co-host Joe here with you all today. Always happy to be in with you all on these weekends of ours. And if you are so happy to be here as well, similarly to me, then, well, you need to thank somebody. You need to thank the Main Street Radio Network for allowing this program to exist. So go to mainstreetradionetwork.com. You'll find out more about the Silk or Joe Show. Find the app for Android phone, Android users. Sorry, Apple users. I'm not dropping $1,000 just so I can compile a line of code, or also dropping another $1,000 to pay someone to make the app for us. Either way, it's going to be an expensive proposition. So just Apple has priced us out of the market because our price is free. Anyway, and you can get all this content for free, mainstreetradionetwork.com. But don't forget to check out the Alan Nathan Show. It was, after all, the late Alan Nathan's birthday earlier this week. And the Alan Nathan Show can be found also on mainstreetradionetwork.com. There's podcasts for both shows up there, both the Silk or Joe Show and the Alan Nathan Show, not both of the shows of the Alan Nathan Show, because we do more than just both. We do five shows for him, or his show, every week, and we only do one show for this a week. And there's also alannathan.com, where you can find out more about the late Alan Nathan. And he missed his birthday here, so as a little gift, you can go check out alannathan.com. There's articles, op-eds, columns by him, as well as, again, the podcast. We want to thank the Silk Radio Network, too, for distributing this show, which can be found on social media, Facebook at Main Street Radio Network, X at Main Street Radio, and, yes, X at Alan Nathan. That's worth checking out because I host the Alan Nathan Show several times a week now. So if you want to know when I'm hosting, X at Alan Nathan, or I guess the other two sources would work just as well for it. Anyway, so right now, I'm just going to drop into just checking my email real quick to see if some emergency about a guest came up. We do have guests lined up for the show, by the way, not in this segment, but later coming along. So Democrats are just kind of blowing up right now in a way. I was about to say, I was about to go into it with some hyperbolic language there, but then I realized, boy, I'm going to sound like those YouTube video headlines that I really hate where, oh, it's the day has come, or this ruined this person's career, whatever. Democrats are going to recover from all this easily. Their voters are very forgiving of their party. Now, what I was thinking of, though, was just the racism implosion. First of all, there's more details about the indictments against the Southern Poverty Law Center, how $4.1 million of tax-exempt money went to the Ku Klux Klan and other such noble causes, according to the Democrats, I guess, because they contributed money to them. The Southern Poverty Law Center did. And you also have the revelations revealed that some of that money actually went to robes and stuff. Wow. They're outright buying the clothing. So, like, at this point, and I think it was like last week or the weekend before, I mentioned that the Patriot Front group did a march near me, wondering how many of those were paid for by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Yeah, they did look like the FBI agents, though. They all looked like the same muscled figures, the same athletic builds, the same clothing, probably the same sunglasses. And it was used as an excuse by like the Black Panthers to do a march here as well, so they're making their own reasons up for doing their stuff. Anyway, though, but aside from continuing to put racism on the map, what else are Democrats doing? You know, for the total dearth of actual racism, they have to drop millions of dollars into the Ku Klux Klan's lap. It seems to belie the reason why the Ku Klux Klan was founded to begin with and its origins. You know, it did not have massive amounts of funding when it was founded. It was just an organization of concerned citizens. Now, granted, they were very much racist, but still, it was an organization of people, grassroots, not big-backed donors, not big institutions funding them like the Democrats are doing now. So the fact that it's not grassroots anymore, the fact that you need this money coming from the top down in the Democrat Party, kind of indicates that there's no real thirst for such an organization in the country anymore. Thus, the cause of racism is now being ill-served. So what do Democrats do? Well, without racism, you don't have a Democrat Party. They've built their brand on fighting racism. What do you do when there is none? You make it up. You keep these organizations around. You keep siphoning money off to them. And of course, you keep being racist yourself. We've seen that with this Nazi dude in Maine. The guy has a Nazi tattoo. Democrats don't denounce him. They cannot bring themselves to denounce him. The closest we got was The View, ABC's The View, Sonny Hostin, one of the hosts there, and you know, the radical nutso leftist cackling hens. She's over there saying, well, yes, the guy is deplorable. He's a racist. But you know what? The guy having a literal Nazi tattoo is still better than Trump. She's forgetting what this district is. It's in Maine. So this means, why did I say district? She's forgetting which state this is, Maine. She's forgetting who this guy's opponent is, Susan Collins. She's not a Trump supporter. She's almost a Democrat. She's almost more of a Democrat than John Fetterman in Pennsylvania. So they're saying that any Republican, no matter how moderate, is worse than a guy with a literal Nazi tattoo on himself. And also a record of racist and sexist and other bigoted remarks. Nope. The moderate senator, the Republican senator there, who's a moderate. Now that she can go because she's a Republican. But boy, this Nazi guy, yeah, he's got to go in there because he's so much better than they really are not thinking beyond what the letter of the name is. I'm wondering if this guy is just like a right winger who's doing this for the, like, when I say right winger, I mean Trump support. I mean, like, you know, the traditional, what the media refers to with a right winger, far right, or, well, far right is anarchy. So I guess a far leftist. Wonder if the guy is just in here to screw with the system. He's just like, okay, you know, I see how the Democrats are. I want to run as one, and I'm just going to troll them. That would be funny if it were the case. If he got elected and he came in and said, hey guys, mea culpa, I'm actually much more fascist than I let on, as if the Nazi tattoo couldn't have discerned that for the discerning Democrat. Speaking of the discerning Democrat, the same ones who are supporting a guy with a Nazi tattoo are trying to remove multiple black representatives from Congress here, I guess. This race just popped into my head literally as I'm talking, but there was the one race over in Tennessee, I think it was, or Kentucky. It was Tennessee where they did the redistricting, and they found that this one district in the corner left side of the state, they were going to wipe that out, and it would end up, if they wiped it out, replacing a white Democrat with a black female Republican. And Democrats are screaming racism. How dare you wipe out this district and put a black female Republican into office, right? Well, they're going beyond that. Now they're going in Florida. You have Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Democrat of some notoriety, who has yet to do anything relevant in the last, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years now. She's been a total flop and a loser. But she's saying that she's going to run not in her home district where she lives after the redistricting in Florida, but rather she's going to run in a safe Democrat district that's majority black and has black representation. And she's going to run against the black representative there. So she's wiping out this white woman, wealthy white woman is coming in to tell the blacks what to do and to claim that she's going to be their voice and all that. And they are rather upset in that district that she's there trying to wipe them out. Actually, I don't know if they have a black congressman or not. I overspoke because there's Elijah Manley, the first candidate. I'm just reading this article from Gateway Pundit. Elijah Manley, the first candidate to enter the primary race for the district seat, noted, "I would not have expected the call would come from inside the house." He's a black man, obviously, talking about Democrats trying to wipe him out. In fact, he says in the following follow-up to that, he says, quote, "I didn't think a white Democrat would be the one to take away a black seat," unquote. So you got this newly district seat, majority black. I guess it doesn't have really a congressman right now, and because it's been redistricting. So with a new district, how can you have a current congressman, right? But they're saying, yep, yeah, it's a majority black, so we're going to have this white Democrat come in and take over. Now, Wasserman Schultz, she argues that she's the best one to do it. a plurality black district, not majority black, plurality black district. And Broward County, too, you might remember them. They're the one where that mass shooting took place because Democrats in control of the school system decided, instead of handling red flags the way they should have, they just shuffle someone around because they don't actually want to lose a student. They don't want to lose a few pennies. They'd rather risk a bunch of students being killed than lose a few pennies of money for having one less head in their classrooms. Anyway, Deputy Westminster Schultz said that her seniority and political clout would allow her to deliver more for the district than a black man. This white woman is superior to black men. Yep, that's what her argument is. And again, this is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who, like I said, hadn't really been relevant in 10 years now. She got booted out from being the chair of the DNC, so she's really been doing nothing since then. Anyway, folks, we got more Silk or Joshua after this break, so stick with us.
As Americans take to the road during the country's 250th anniversary, Hilton is joining the fun by offering 12 unexpected summer road trip experiences to Hilton Honors members, each with a Hampton by Hilton stay along the way. From cross-country adventures with a 2026 Jeep Grand Cherokee and a year of free gas to quirky festivals like UFO sightings in Roswell and pickle celebrations in Pittsburgh, these Hilton Honors America experiences bring the American road trip to life. Hilton's Shruti Gandhi Buckley explains.
As we celebrate the 250th anniversary of our country, travelers are rediscovering the joy of the open road. For generations, Hampton by Hilton has been a trusted home base for road trips, offering comfort, convenience, and welcoming service that make every mile easier. These experiences capture the fun and spontaneity of piling in the car and hitting the road.
Hilton Honors America experiences will drop throughout the summer and are first come, first serve. Visit experiences.hiltonhonors.com for more information.
Building Safety Month, an awareness campaign by the International Code Council, highlights how codes implemented across the country and safety professionals keep us safe. This year's theme, Built to Last, starts with how you can get involved. ICC CEO John Belsick explains.
Building safety starts at home because that's where people spend most of their time. We often see that small issues like overloaded outlets, loose handrails, or blocked exits can turn into serious risks if they're not addressed.
Another focus this year, resilience, especially as natural disasters become more frequent.
Modern building codes are one of the most effective tools we have when it comes to disaster resilience. They're designed to reduce damage, protect the people inside, and help communities recover quicker from disasters like hurricanes and wildfires.
And accessibility is key.
Communities Without Limits means designing buildings and public spaces that are usable, intuitive, and welcoming for people of all ages and abilities.
To learn more, including how to reach out to local representatives to advocate for the latest codes, visit buildingsafetymonth.org.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm Jason Derulo. I love that music connects to people all over the country. But unfortunately, so does something else. Childhood hunger. 15 million kids struggle with hunger right here in America. And yet, every year, billions of pounds of surplus food in the U.S. go to waste instead of going to the children in need. Feeding America is working to change this. The Feeding America nationwide network of food banks rescues this surplus of food to help provide meals to families in virtually every community in the United States, including yours. But they just can't do this alone. Join me in the fight against hunger in America. For more information on what you can do to get involved, visit feedingamerica.org. That's feedingamerica.org. Together we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America. A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at PVA.org.
Welcome back to the Silker Joe Show. My co-host Joe with you all today. My guest might be about to make a liar out of me. I said in the last segment we'd have a guest, and we do have him now. So we are joined by Phil Kirpin, and I have the wrong guest list up, so I'm not going to give an accurate bio, but he is president of American Commitment. I was about to say Americans for Commitment, because we have so many Americans for this and that and the other thing on this program. But yes, Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment, no four in there, and Committee to Unleash Prosperity. He's also contributor to Fox News Opinion, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, and author of the book Democracy Denied. Phil Kirpin, have had you on so many times, I should know this bio by heart, but how are you today?
I am doing great. How are you?
I am doing well, thank you. Aside from my usual thing, I don't know, whenever I email a document to someone, I close out of it, even if I need to be reading it. So that's what happened to, unfortunately, your bio here.
Muscle memory.
But we're talking now about the healthcare industry and how the expenses have just gone way out of control, skyrocketing. We're blaming everybody. We're blaming Congress, this, that, the other thing. But there's also a role that the hospitals have been playing, and about driving increased costs, particularly as a result of government paying and payments and tax policies. What's going on here?
Well, we've seen mass consolidation of the hospital sector as a result of a number of federal policies, one of them being the Medicare payment policies that say that if a hospital system buys a physician's practice, the government will now pay more, will pay a higher rate in Medicare for the same office visit to the same doctor than they did when he was independent. And so you can imagine how that's driven a lot of consolidation, but also the tax issue. And we've got these giant hospital systems that are tax exempt, that style themselves as nonprofits, even though they bring in massive, massive amounts of money and their executives make a fortune and they sponsor sports teams and sports venues. And so they can buy up and all kinds of other providers, physicians groups, imaging centers, clinics, and so forth, take them off the tax rolls and just get an instant windfall from no longer having to pay taxes. And so I think these have been some of the drivers. Now, there are others as well. I mean, we had a ban on physician-owned hospitals that came in under Obamacare. That limited competition. You've got a lot of state-level rules and regulations that inhibit competition, and you've got all of the bureaucracy, the regulatory burdens that come with all the laws that we've had, with not just Obamacare but all the other related federal rules and regulations and state rules and regulations. All of that makes it much easier to just say, I'm going to sell my practice, become an employee of a hospital system, because they've got somebody to deal with all that. They've got a department, a billing department, a compliance department. They've got people to deal with all of that, and I think that's why we've seen this trend. The change has been pretty stark in a pretty short period of time. Before Obamacare passed 15 years ago, about 20% of doctors were employed by hospitals or other corporate entities. It's now over 60%, and so it's been a massive, massive change, and it has seen, that change in kind of the structure of the industry has led to much, much higher prices, because there's just much less competition. And the hospitals can just raise their prices higher and higher and higher. And the insurance companies that are generally the payers along with the government, they don't have a lot of choices. And the hospitals keep crying poverty, even though they've been, bringing in massive amounts of money. And so we've got a big challenge with that part of it. Also, on the insurance part, too, we have very limited competition. We've got a handful of giant insurance companies that have bought up a bunch of providers and bought up the pharmacy benefit managers. And so in most of the country now, you might have one or two health systems in your town that control almost all of the providers, and two or three insurers that are pretty much the only payers in town. And so if you're trying to find a better deal, find a better price, good luck, because there's just not much competition. There's not much choice that's out there. And I think Republicans, including President Trump, to their credit, have talked a lot about, let's get control of your healthcare dollars away from the insurance companies. Let's put the money into an account that you own and control, whether it's, subsidy money from the government or money from an employer. Let's try to get transparent pricing so that we can have a functioning market. And I'm for all of that. But if we don't fix the supply issue, if we don't reverse these consolidation trends, if we don't make sure there are actually providers that you can choose from, then that's not going to accomplish a whole lot. You're just going to be sending the money to the same handful of insurance companies to pay the same handful of health systems. And so I think it's really critical that we address and reverse these consolidation drivers so that people really have more choice and competition, and, you know, we can bring down prices in a way that, it's not trying to force them down through government regulation or brute force, but bringing them down through increasing supply, which is, the pro-growth way to do it.
It seems like that at the moment, then, we're on the path to a single-payer system when one of these insurance companies finally conquers the entire market. And I remember Obamacare Republicans at the time criticizing it as being a pathway to single payer or something like that. Well, it ended up becoming that, just, I guess, not the way anyone really anticipated.
Well, most markets, it's not single payer, but it's getting pretty close, because we got the government is a huge payer, and then you've got, basically two or three insurance companies in most markets. So we're down to, whatever, quad payer, triple payer, something like that. But, it's dwindling pretty rapidly in that direction.
Yeah, and that means also there's hardly any competition as well for the consumer to choose from. And in which case, if your insurer is doing a bad job, oh well, because are we going to get to the point where we have health insurance companies that are just too big to fail and we got to bail them out? Are we going to get to the point where when they eat each other up, finally we'll just have one big company that's too big to fail?
Well, the insurers are largely becoming kind of government contractors or utilities, if you think about it, because they're so heavily regulated and the business models are so heavily prescribed by regulation. And most of their money comes from government programs now, from the various subsidies, running Medicaid managed care, running the Obamacare subsidies. And so we've got a pretty weird situation. I mean, look at a company like United Health, which is the largest health insurer. Before Obamacare passed, they were about 80-20 private versus government. Now it's 80-20 the other way. About 80% of their revenue comes from government programs. And so when you run a company on that basis, are you really a private company? Are you more like a contractor where everything depends on your political influence and you're not really subject to normal market pressures because, you rise and fall on, how much money you can extract from the government? And that unfortunately has been the direction we've been moving very rapidly.
Yeah, and I guess my initial thought is, why didn't Republicans do anything about this in 2017, 2018? Because I remember them coming on.
Don't remind me, John McCain and the thumbs down and all of that. I mean, it was, I tell you, my favorite story about that is, the problem, of course, is they had, instead of having, it wasn't that they didn't have any plans for health care, it was they had about 10 different plans, and they couldn't agree on it, and they were not organized. And I'll never forget when Pat Toomey, who was a senator from Pennsylvania at the time, was asked, like, why aren't you guys ready to go with your health care plan? He actually did one of the rarest things from a politician. He told the truth, and he said, oh, we thought Hillary was going to win. And it's like, oh, okay, great.
Yeah, I absolutely got that impression when Trump won that was totally unexpected and that the campaigns had been built upon the assumption that maybe he's not going to win. Maybe it will be Hillary Clinton being president. They banked a little too much on that. So what?
Right now on health care, it's a crazy thing because remember last year the Democrats shut down the government for about 7 weeks. They said it's going to be the end of the world if the supersized Obamacare subsidies from COVID go back to the regular Obamacare subsidies, which are very generous themselves, by the way. And they said, oh my God, this is going to be so terrible and we're going to shut down the government. And Republicans for once held firm and they did not extend the supersized subsidies. And they said, we think, the government paying 85% of your premiums instead of 95 is plenty. We're not going to extend the supersized subsidies. None of the things they said would happened. And so they just changed the subject. Now they do a shutdown about ICE and Republicans let them. They're not talking about health care either.
Well, Phil Kirpin, where can the listeners find out more about this? We've got 10 seconds left here.
Go to AmericanCommitment.org or go to MostFavoredPatient.org, which is the other healthcare project I'm working on.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show to talk about all this. Listeners, we got more programming coming up after this break, so stick with us.
Memorial Day is the first big cookout of the summer, and for many, that means firing up the grill and gathering with friends and family. With fresh ways to elevate your cookout menu, here's culinary instructor and cookbook author Brooke Parkhurst.
For me, it's not a summer cookout without Bush's Baked Beans. They're a classic staple that pair perfectly with all of your barbecue favorites. And their rich, slow-simmered flavor brings everyone to the table.
Bush's Baked Beans work alongside everything, from grilled meats to simple sides. And with flavors like original and brown sugar hickory, they offer a savory sweet twist to everyday meals.
My summer menu, I'm serving up dishes like Bush's barbecue chicken nachos. They're fun, shareable, and perfect for bringing everybody together. And for something a little bit heartier, Bush's baked beans with brisket. They're my go-to. It's smoky, satisfying, and guaranteed to keep everybody coming back for seconds.
For recipes and summer entertaining ideas, visit bushbeans.com.
As summer arrives and people head outside, doctors are preparing for what they call trauma season, a time when serious injuries and ER visits spike nationwide. May is National Stop the Bleed Month, a time when everyone should learn how to respond to a bleeding emergency. With more, here's Dr. David Scott Shapiro, chair of the American College of Surgeons' Stop the Bleed Committee.
Uncontrolled bleeding is a leading cause of preventable death. Thousands of lives could be saved every year if bystanders learn to control that severe bleeding and are empowered to act immediately at the scene, even before EMS arrives.
The American College of Surgeons urges everyone to learn three simple steps: apply firm pressure, pack the wound, and use a tourniquet when needed.
A person with serious bleeding can bleed to death within minutes. These are practical skills anyone can learn and use in those first critical moments. The ACS Stop the Bleed course is made for everyone.
To find training and to get an ACS Stop the Bleed kit, visit stopthebleed.org/summer.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and did you know that feeding birds is good for your mental health? A 2024 study confirmed what millions of Americans are already discovering. Birding isn't just a hobby, it's a wellness habit. Just 30 minutes of bird watching has been shown to reduce stress more effectively than a standard walk outdoors. Wildlife advocate Adrian Chizis is the director of consumer and bird engagement at Global Harvest Foods.
That daily ritual of noticing, watching, and being present is one of the simplest and most accessible good day habits anyone can build this month. And it's remarkably easy. You could be a bird watcher by the end of the day. All you need is a feeder, a bag of quality seed, and a spot near a window where you can enjoy the view.
Quality seed like Cool Bird Specialty Blends or Audubon Park Snack Stacks make it easy and keep the birds coming back. Visit morecoolbirds.com or audubonpark.com for beginner-friendly tips, seed guidance, and ideas for attracting birds to your yard.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Al Nathan. Oh my God. Welcome back to the Silk or Joe show, everybody. Because I was just thinking, what did I talk about this on the Al and Nathan show? I forgot. If I didn't, I should have, because I hosted the Al and Nathan show yesterday. So that's why, you know, I'm sitting here trying to think, did I cover this on the show or not? But yeah, this item here, it was in my browser tab, wanted to get to it. And I was just thinking, did I Did I talk about this on the show yesterday or not? But John Bolton agrees to plead guilty over mishandling classified documents. So everybody remembers John Bolton, of course. Gosh, I remember the late Alan Nathan. Before John Bolton showed his true colors in the Trump administration, the late Alan Nathan kept badgering me to get him on the Alan Nathan show. Contact the Heritage Foundation. Get this guy on. He's such a great guest. A big name to have is really what was the attraction here. Get this big name on my show again. He'd been on before. I want him on again. Reach out. Keep trying to get him. And then eventually we see what he does when he's in the first Trump administration. Just wants to be, just wants to go to war with everybody and ends up getting fired for it. So now he's agreeing to plead guilty over mishandling classified information. And let's see, he was national security advisor or under the first Trump administration. Pled guilty to a felony. Ooh, he just lost his right to vote, didn't he? 60 days in jail and $2.25 million in fines? That's a big felony, isn't it? Anyway, he intends to plead guilty to, this is a quote from CNN, he intends to plead guilty to one count of illegal retention of sensitive national security documents, according to one of the sources. He has also agreed to pay a more than $2 million fine, according to one of the sources. These anonymous sources, bleh. That's what I say about anonymous sources. And CNN is the one who mentions that the conviction could result in 60 months, possibly. The plea deal comes after the top Trump foe was charged by prosecutors in Maryland for allegedly keeping diary entries from the first Trump White House in his home. And the FBI raided his home last year. So they were sent to his home because he apparently sent highly sensitive classified materials to family members from a private unsecured email server while he was working at the White House. Well, at least someone got held accountable for doing that. Hillary Clinton never did. Hillary Clinton didn't even get held accountable for lying to Congress about that stuff. So, actually, the Biden administration, though, they could have been the ones to knock him off. But they stopped the investigation. He's guilty of sin, but the Biden administration halted the investigation. I wonder if some of John Bolton turning against Trump, doing all the media hits and all that during the Biden administration, I wonder if that softened the hand of justice under the Biden administration DOJ. Maybe that's the recipe for success if you are facing an indictment by a Democrat administration. You just come out and say, I'm a good person now. I'm one of you. I hate the previous guy. I'm going to lend my credibility to every talking point you have. Just please don't throw me in jail. That's all you got to do. Please don't throw me in jail. What a corrupt, crooked deal, but what do you expect? We were talking about Westerman Schultz in the opening segment. Well, her term in the DNC was well noted for its crooked, corrupt deals. She ended up presiding over the DNC during that whole time where they selected Hillary Clinton. You might recall that, the 2016 election cycle, where by hook or by crook, they were going to get Hillary Clinton, but they wanted to pretend that they were Democratic. So they got like four lightweights to go up against her, and they even changed the questions that she would receive. I remember that when one of the questions was, do Black Lives Matter? There's a lot of people out there, sidebar, who think that Black Lives Matter, all that started in 2020. No, it started in 2013. And they were asking these questions in the 2016 Democrat primaries. Do Black Lives Matter? And then when Hillary Clinton was asked the question, she was asked a slightly different version of that, which I guess she was asked that because of her own questionable history with advocating things that liberals think that were very harmful to the Black community. The tough-on-crime approaches that the Clinton administration took in the 90s, for example. And Hillary Clinton coining the phrase super predators. And she was confronted actually by that. I got the clip for the late Alan Nathan years ago where she was confronted by an activist over her term, her use of the word super predator. But she didn't ignore it. She ignored it because she knew she'd win. Just as we were talking in the last segment, Republicans knew that she'd win. So yeah, why bother campaigning on anything that we can actually do anything about when we know that we're not going to be winning the presidency? Why bother listening to these voters here when you know they're going to come out and vote for you anyway? It's like when Joe Biden said that if you don't vote Democrat, you're not black. I'm sorry, there's too many knots in there. I was just trying to make sure I didn't have a double negative. if you don't vote Democrat, you aren't black. It sounds like it should be a double negative, but it isn't. So that same party that takes just certain swaths of the voting public for granted, which rightly so, Hillary Clinton comes out and just, yeah, I don't really, I can ignore this person accusing me of racism. It's no problem. Certainly, there was no problem. Because look how many votes she got. She still got the popular vote back then. So it didn't matter how racist she'd been in the past. It didn't matter how sexist she'd been in the past. It didn't matter that she tried to cover up for her husband's alleged raping by referring to them as the Bimbo Brigade or something like that. Bimbo Eruption. That's what she said. Bimbo Eruption is how she termed it when people came out and accused her husband of rape. You know, the same Democrats who, after voting $65 million for the woman who said bimbo eruptions, would then now be on board with the Me Too movement and say, believe all women. Well, apparently not. Just why are you saying believe all women now when just a month ago you voted for the person who referred to accusers as bimbos? So, vapid, animated hypocrisy of the Democrat Party on full display for anyone who cares to look, except the Democrats, because, you know, they just have the echoing refrain, I'm a good person, playing in their heads. At least the voters do. The politicians, of course, they're politicians. They know what they're doing. But the average voter out there just seems to think, I'm a good person, so I'm going to do this, and I'm not going to think too far into the past. I'm not going to think into the past at all. So little so that I'm not even going to remember the past of this country, because we have coming up less than a month till the 4th of July. There's a new poll out that shows that 1 in 5 Democrats are proud to be Americans. And I guess the 1 in 5 Democrats are the John Fetterman crowd. This is reported by the New York Post here. Quote, fewer than 1 in 5 Democrats, fewer than 1 in 5, great, feel proud to be American ahead of 250th birthday, compared to 2 in 3 of Republicans. And let's see, those surveyed were asked what term best described how they felt when they thought about the United States marking its semi-quincentennial anniversary, and Dems had almost nothing good to say. Just 18% said that they were proud. 17% felt they were grateful. 17% of Democrats are grateful to live here? Boy, wonder what country they'd rather live in. Let's see, perhaps Gaza under Hamas, unfettered. Because right now, of course, they're not going to want to live there because they say Israel's committing a genocide. But what if Hamas had its way and Gaza was ran without interference, exactly as Hamas would indicate? Maybe Democrats would be more comfortable in that environment. They should move there. I'd love to see it. Bolster Hamas's numbers. They'd certainly vote for a Hamas candidate. 21% of Democrats said they felt conflicted about America, 15% disappointed, 6% frustrated, and 24% had no strong feelings. This is just the place I live. Those are probably the global citizen crowd. Yeah, it's just a place. I'm not really attached to anything here. It explains how they vote, doesn't it? Where they just vote for the government to pay for everything. They don't care. They're not attached. I have no sentimental value for this place. I don't care if it's ran into the ground. I just want my free crap right now. It reminds me of this interesting meme that I saw going around the web, this contrast between Democrats and Republicans. You're a good communist if you consume, spend, drop out of society. Whereas if you're a Republican, whereas you're a good capitalist if you're contributing to the world and building families and all that sort of thing. Because it was contrasting the values Democrats have, which is consume what the big corporations tell you and just do what they tell you, do what everyone tells you, consume, spend, vote, whatever, just do it the way you're told. And in the meantime, you can sit at home and drug yourself out and eat your highly processed foods and all that sort of thing. Just like the exact thing that Democrats say was so wrong that Republicans are so evil for doing or whatever is what they're doing, to the point where you have their anti-fascist protesters out there trying to protest against people who are really protesting against fascism. I've mentioned it, I think, before on this show or the Al Nathan show, where you had that one protest against the drug companies and the vaccine mandates and all that sort of thing, and anti-fascist protesters interrupted that. These people who are protesting against corporate control of the government are being disrupted by the anti-fascists, the ones who claim to stand for being against such control. Is it any wonder that there's billionaires backing the anti-fascist crowd, right? They just operate at the behest of the billionaire. So I guess going back to this poll here about Democrats, that's the kind of group we have, the one that are probably numbed by pot anyway, and just really, they'd drop out of society if they could. And only 1% of Republicans, by the way, said they felt disappointed about America. 1% felt frustrated, and 9% had no strong feelings. And by the way, these polls over the years have indicated that conservatives, regardless of who's president, still tend to feel majority in support of America over Democrats, for sure, showing who really is patriotic. More Silk or Joe Show after this break.
She has a brilliant mind.
I just don't know how to be. She does have a knack of being right. I've seen this before. We haven't got much time.
One of PBS's fan-favorite crime dramas, Patience, returns to PBS this Sunday for an all-new season. Streaming with PBS Passport and PBS Masterpiece on Prime Video, the British crime series follows an autistic criminal records clerk named Patience Evans, who uses her unique analytical skills to spot connections that others may not see. In Season 2, a new detective creates tension with Patience, but they must work as a team to solve murder cases across the city. Patience joins PBS's expansive catalog of mysteries. From beloved classics to newer hits, there's a mystery around every corner, and mystery loves company. Don't miss Patience, streaming this Sunday with PBS Passport and PBS Masterpiece on Prime Video.
According to a recent survey from Credit One Bank, nearly 40% of Gen Z adults feel stressed about their financial situation. With suffocating college loans, increasing inflation, and a challenging job market, it's easy to understand why. Best-selling personal finance author Beth Kobliner helps young adults navigate their financial future with Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. The new fifth edition of the iconic Money Guide helps young people dig out of credit card debt, reduce spending, and implement a budget, choose a student loan repayment plan, boost their credit score, and start saving. Author Beth Kobliner.
You know, most recent college graduates could use a roadmap highlighting the money basics they may not have learned in school. In my book, Get a Financial Life, I help them create a workable, no-nonsense plan to pay down debt, spend smarter, and save for a healthy financial future.
The perfect graduation gift, Get a Financial Life, is now available wherever books are sold.
My name is Judy Teeter, and I'm the mother of three boys. My youngest, Joe, was a great kid. He loved sports, music, and his youth group. One day, Joe asked me to drive him to an after-school event, which was about a mile from our home. I was driving through a green light when a car in cross traffic ran a red light and drove right into the side of our car, killing Joe. The driver was talking on her phone, so she never even saw the red light. She was so absorbed in her phone call. Before the crash, I didn't realize just talking on a cell phone while driving was so dangerous. Now it's something I think about every day. According to the National Safety Council, about 1 in 4 car crashes involves a cell phone. Hands-free is no safer. When you're behind the wheel, put away your phone. For Joe and for the thousands of needless deaths every year. Remember, there is no safe way to talk on a cell phone while driving. Find out more at nsc.org/callskill.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover guitar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair, and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all gotta help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're gonna be saving our lives. To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Welcome back to the Silk or Joe Show, everybody. Co-host Joe with you all today. And we're wrapping up now with Steve Malloy. He is Executive Director of the National Center for Public Policy Research's Free Enterprise Project. He was a member of President Trump's EPA transition team in 2016 and is founder of junkscience.com. He is also author of Scare Pollution, Why and How to Fix the EPA. Steve Malloy, always happy to talk with you. How are you today?
Hey, Joseph. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad to have you. So, what do you make of Alphabet, the Google parent company? They seem to have not much in the way of viewpoint diversity on their board and senior leadership positions, which I suppose could blind them to especially their own biases, but also market opportunities. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so it's well known that Alphabet, parent of Google, has a leftist point of view. And, of course, they have exercised that with respect to climate, which I do a lot of work on. They have, you know, for example, demonetized my website, junkscience.com. They've demonetized group, other climate skeptic groups like the Heartland Institute. And, of course, all this has come back to haunt them now because, Google and the rest of big tech, they want to build these data centers. There's kind of a crunch right now. The public is reacting badly to it. So, they're in a real fix. And, of course, you know, they could have avoided this a long time ago. Had they, you know, just had some viewpoint diversity, listened to climate skeptics, listened to energy experts about how vital fossil fuels are. Google completely missed how popular AI would be, and they completely missed how much energy would be needed. And, they pushed the climate hoax for such a long time that it actually hurt our energy production, and now we have to catch up. But, you know, demand for AI is much greater than the amount of electricity we have available. So, you know, viewpoint diversity, the lack thereof, has become a real problem for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of something I saw a YouTuber commenting the other day about how, actually it was this morning, you know, we got to give up our cars, we got to give up our wood stoves, we got to give up our appliances. Oh, but data centers are fine.
Well, yeah, we wouldn't be having this problem today if these guys wouldn't have the, you know, left-wing bias that they have against energy and if they hadn't pushed the climate hoax. Energy, we should have plenty of energy for everything we need, but of course we're behind the curve because for the last 20 years we've been, you know, junking up our grid with wind and solar and batteries and also, you know, dumping on EVs and heat pumps and all sorts of things that, you know, have really damaged our grid to the point where it's really dangerously unstable, especially during peak demand. And now we have data centers coming. It's just, it's a mess. And, people are resenting all the, you know, data centers everywhere. If we had just done things differently, if they had gotten some different points of view, all of big tech would be much better off. We'd all be much better off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, right now in the state of Virginia, we have Democrats fighting Democrats over data centers. It's not just one side versus the other. It's, you know, you're either for data centers or against. It seems to cross party lines as to who's on whose side here.
Yeah, no, and it's on the right as well. I mean, Republicans, conservatives are fighting each other over data centers, and it's really, you know, it's really something that could have been avoided. But, you know, when you only have one point of view in the boardroom, which is always bad business, you're going to get disaster. So that's why we have a shareholder proposal that I'm presenting tomorrow. You can listen to it today if you go to my website, junkscience.com, or my X feed at junkscience. You can listen to my 2-minute proposal. It's very quick, very clear. And Alphabet's board is going to get it tomorrow.
Well, unfortunately, this airs Saturday, so we just gave away when this aired.
No.
So yesterday is what you meant. Yesterday you presented to the
yesterday,
board.
Yesterday, right.
But now I just have, anyway, I will ask for speculation, though. How do you think it will be received?
Well, I think these people are very arrogant. They're going to have to hear it more than once. They're going to have to be confronted with it. There's nothing more arrogant than corporate boards, and big tech is the most arrogant of all.
And I think part of it, too, is just despite all the conflicts over data centers, despite how perhaps even the politicians that some of these folks support would be against data centers, at the same time, you have other politicians of the same political party who are willing to bend the knee to them.
This is one of those cross-party issues. Whatever side you're on, there's all sorts of confusion about this, and it's really needless. And it all goes back to this, viewpoint diversity. You're only going to hear one side, you're always going to make a mistake because there's lots of viewpoints out there, and you need to consider all sides, all information before making decisions, and that is not being done in corporate America today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as long as when it comes to politics too, as long as someone from your side, your chosen side, is still on your side, you still think that my viewpoint and lack of diversity thereof is still justified, even if everyone else is saying no to you. We still have this one stalwart hanging out, so we're good.
It's unfortunate that humans can't get together, and if you have just like a lone dissenter, we should be able to suss that out and figure out whether the guy has a point or not, or the person has a point or not. But we don't do that. We just we take this sort of democratic approach to it. You're outvoted. You could be right, but we're all wrong. But if we can outvote you, then we're right, right? So might makes right. That's sort of the theory here, and that's not good.
Yeah, as Stacey Abrams, she referred to competitive authoritarianism. That's what she referred to democracy as.
That's how it is. That's not how it should be, but that's how it is.
All right. So has it always been this way, though, in the corporate boardrooms, in particular for Google, before, say, the Trump era, where everyone got so radicalized to one side or the other? Had they always been this way, or is this just an outgrowth of that?
Well, I mean, these companies have been politicized for the last 25 or so years. The left started politicizing them in the 1980s. Their goal was to become shareholders and to actually capture the corporation and to use their influence and resources to advance their political agenda. And as of about the Obama administration, they had basically accomplished that. And so, I started working on this 20 years ago when they were first starting to have success capturing Wall Street firms. Most large corporations are run by leftists. And so as conservatives, what we do at the Free Enterprise Project at the National Center is we're trying to get corporations back to business and get out of politics.
All right. Well, Steve Molloy, appreciate being on the show. Where can listeners find out more about the Free Enterprise Project? About 10 seconds left here.
FreeEnterpriseProject.org. You follow me on X at Junk Science.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show to talk about this. And listeners, thank you all for tuning in to the Silker Joe Show this weekend. Our websites are MainStreetRadioNetwork.com and why not AlanNathan.com, since I host that show several times a week anyway. Be seeing you.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. Please consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-978-0600 or at our website, MainStreetRadioNetwork.com.